session number 25197, Reel 5.
Derek Bartlett, Reel 5.
So the fire was successfully conquered in the ship, and we made our way down to Perth in Western Australia. And we pulled in there to Fremantle Harbour at night, and in the morning the tugs came and nudged the ship into the dock side of the wharf. And one particular memory of that morning is that we all stood at the rail taking in our first sight of Western Australia, which was the docks of Fremantle, of course, and all round the ship was swimming a large number of sharks. A large number. And then we disembarked and we were put into buses and taken to a variety of different places, of course. Different families went to different hotels and boarding houses and so on. And we went to a place called the Shaftesbury Hotel in Stirling Street, near the railway station. And what we didn't know at the time was that the Shaftesbury Hotel was certainly a hotel, but it was also a bordello. And we found this out the hard way. Now, I have to say, first of all, that at that age, I had no notion of sex at all, really, none at all. So the word brothel to me would have meant nothing, bordello, nothing at all. I had no idea what it was about. And we were put on the first floor. It was a Victorian building. It had been built about the middle of the 19th century. So it was one of the older buildings at Perth. And it was stone and timber, and not uncommon in Australian cities then. It had a first floor veranda, which actually was built out over the footpath with a couple of timber columns. It was a timber construction and a pitched roof, and so one could actually sit on the veranda and watch people walking up and down the street and underneath. You see, it was really quite interesting. And it was, as I say, fairly typical of that sort of establishment in those days, from an architectural point of view.
And that was in Perth?
It was in Perth itself, yes. So we were discharged there and disgorged there, and we were taken onto the first floor, right at the far end of a long corridor, to a very large room at the rear of the hotel. And this was a very big bedroom. I suppose the ceiling heights would have been about 12 feet, certainly, because of the heat. All the rooms were behind. And it had one of those marvellous plaster features around the central light, very, very Victorian, and heavy mouldings on the ceiling and so on. And it had a double bed, and a single bed, which my mother slept in. So we three children slept in the double bed, you see. So there was myself. I was nearly nine. And my eldest sister, who was about 7 1/2, and then the young one, who was 3. And we slept in that double bed. And there was one very large vertical sliding sash window, which gave out onto a flat roof. And it was very, very hot because it was January 1942. And in Australia, the Southern Hemisphere, of course, it's summer then, around that time. My mother discovered very quickly that it was a brothel, because she began to be taken for one of the ladies, which annoyed her. She was furious most of the time we were there. And so she found that this was the situation. Of course, she couldn't go anywhere else, because the problem was that my father's status as an RAF officer and also an employee of the Air Ministry meant that she was paid a sum of money each month. Wherever she was, they would arrange for her to be able to go to a bank and collect the money. So at least that was one plus. And they were also paying her fares. So she didn't have to worry about money for travelling. And she did have some spending money. And they paid the hotel bills all the time. Wherever we went, they paid the bills. So she didn't have to worry about paying the bills. But for four people, it wasn't all that much money per month, actually. And I think looking back on it now, I realised that she was actually struggling financially, in actual fact. Because we used to say, as children do, well, would you buy us this or would you buy us that? And she was always saying, no, I can't afford it. I don't think, having been in Singapore, of course, where if we said, would you buy us this? Very often they wouldn't buy it, because they had that sort of standard, that sort of money available. But when we got down to Perth, of course, I think she was really quite a difficult position. And she wouldn't do it, and of course we didn't understand why. Anyway, we settled into the hotel, and we could have all our meals there, if free of charge, if we want. So we used to have breakfast and a light lunch, and then the meal in the evening. The main feature on the menu was duck and roast peas and potatoes, and it featured all the time. And we got very, very tired of roast duck. And there was a concierge there. She virtually ran the place. A large lady who looked, of course, I'm coming forward many years now, Barry Humphries in his role as Edna Everidge. When I think of that woman in the hotel, I think of Edna Everidge now, because she was exactly like that. In fact, I sometimes wondered whether he'd ever known that woman, because she's so similar. But she had this very, very broad Australian accent. And when we came down the stairs, the main staircase discharged as usual into the reception lounge, and she was always sitting at a desk so that she could see the main entrance and everything else. And she was always there. She always seemed to be there. And as we came down, she'd say, "Hello, darlings. How are you?" I started to pick up, to my mother's horror, I started to pick up an Australian accent very, very quickly, and so did my sisters. And when I look at Edna Everidge now, it's just so reminiscent. It's uncanny. But she played the piano for the guys in the evening in the bar lounge, you see. And in saying that, I have to explain that at that time, Perth, as a result of the attack on Malaya and Singapore, was full of Australian troops, some British troops, and a very large contingent of American naval personnel and some American troops as well. It was transformed almost overnight, I would imagine, from a very quiet country town, quite small, with a couple of thousand miles of desert on the east and the Indian Ocean on the west. My mother saying to me at one stage that she thought it looked rather like a combination of an English country town and an American Wild West town. But of course I didn't know anything about that in those days, so it didn't mean much to me at the time. I suppose the thing that made her think of that was the fact that if you got on the tram and you went far enough, the tram lines just died in the desert. And then the driver went round to the other end of the tram and drove it back again. The tram lines literally stopped in the sand. It was like that. And it was a one-horse town, in effect. And it suddenly, overnight, it was transformed from this little backwater to a place which was a military encampment. There were thousands of service personnel when we arrived there. Now, of course, this meant that the pubs and the hotel bars and the brothels were doing a roaring trade, as indeed was the Shaftesbury Hotel. And in the evenings, the Australians in those days, and I don't know whether they still do, they used to run the so-called 6 o'clock swill. And the pubs used to open for a very short time, and everybody would come rolling out, totally drunk, I think, 90% of them anyway. And then the fights would start between the British troops and the Australian troops and the American, mainly naval personnel. And there was a pub just down the road from the hotel where this happened every single night except Sunday. And respectable people like my mother flatly refused to go out on the street at that particular time of day. But we used to stand on the veranda and watch these fights going on, with the military police racing up and down in their trucks. And it happened all over Perth every night. And then later on, the bars, such as the bar in the Shaftesbury Hotel, will fill up with the same sort of people. But the more respectable ones would be the officers. But because the Shaftesbury Hotel was a bordello, we used to get the ORs, as it were. And again, the fights and the scraps over the women in the hotel itself. And of course, I'd seen a lot as a child by that time, but I still didn't know what they were fighting about. So we used to my mother used to confine us to a room after dinner. Absolutely no way were we permitted to go down into the hotel. And we had the most frightening experience one night. I don't know at what point during our stay there this occurred. I think it was probably in the fairly early stages. We were sitting in our room reading. My mother was a great bibliophile. She was a voracious reader and very widely read. And she introduced us to books as soon as we could. Almost babies, I think, when she did this. I can't remember a life without books. She had, fortunately, she had taken some books with her, and she, as soon as we arrived in Perth, she went to the bookshops there and she bought a variety of books that would suit us. And we used to sit and read in the evenings, with the piano tinkling away in the bar, you know, down the corridor. And we were sitting there one night reading, and suddenly there was a tremendous hammering on our door, which at that time of day she always kept locked on the inside. And it became apparent that this fellow was trying to get in for reasons that I need not labour. Although, of course, I didn't know why he wanted to come in, and my mother wouldn't tell me. Now, the room was furnished with very heavy Victorian mahogany furniture. There was a large double wardrobe, a thing we used to call a tall boy, with about 5 drawers in it, and various other things like that. And the bed, of course. A huge mahogany bedstead, you know. Grand Victorian thing. She said to me, "Help me to pull this tall boy up against the door." It was enormously heavy, but between us we managed to inch it over to the door and ram it up against the door. And he was really, by that time, really making an enormous amount of trouble. I mean, hammering on the door, really trying to force his way in. And we got the furniture up against the door, and then we leant against the tall boy as well, the two of us. And eventually, and of course we got all the effing and blinding as well as a result of it. Now, I'd never heard language like that before, and I hadn't the faintest idea what it meant. But my mother said, "Well, don't take notice of it." So we just leaned against the door, against the tall boy, and very gradually he realised that he wasn't going to get anywhere to wait. So we left the tall boy there all night. And in the morning, she complained to the concierge, who that day they fixed two more bolts onto the inside of the door.
Did you have any idea how the Australians regarded? You were refugees, really, weren't you?
We most
refugees
certainly were.
From Singapore,
yes.
You know, how you were regarded. Did they open their arms?
No. No, it would be wrong to say no, categorically. The Women's Volunteer Service and organisations of that sort, there was the YMCA and the the YWCA. People of that sort, they were very helpful and kind. And she did go to them on a number of occasions. And there were some people living in that area of Perth who knew that we were refugees. And of course there were, I should say that in addition to all the troops and military and naval personnel there were thousands of refugees like ourselves. And some people, men of course, not women and children, used to sleep in the doorways of shops. Yes, there were so many there. And they were very helpful and kind and welcoming, really. They even put on a street party for us when we'd been there about 3 weeks. It was very, very kind of them. But there were others who were very antagonistic and aggressive. And we went into a chemist shop just across the bridge from the, over the railway bridge, there was a chemist shop. And I went in there by my mother and she said, oh, you're English, are you? And I can't remember the exact words, of course. My mother said, yes, you know, we're from Singapore. And she said, I suppose you've had all these niggers looking after you all these years, have you? Now you expect us to do it. That was the kind of comment we got. So my mother said, no, they're not niggers in Singapore and Malaya. Malays. But that was the attitude we had from quite a lot of people. A degree of aggression, resentment, really. They also resented the fact that they resented the what they regarded as the failure of Britain to defend Singapore and therefore Australia. And they were, if I say there was a degree of, what shall I say, again, anxiety among the people of Perth, it would be a fair comment. There had been a bombing raid on Darwin by then, you see. And they were very worried indeed. They were very worried. But we found attitudes varied enormously. In some places very kind, very, very welcoming. In others, complete rejection.
Did your mother have a long-term plan? You know, was she aiming to get you out of Australia?
Eventually home, yes. Oh, yes, that was the whole purpose. Yeah.
How easy was that to arrange?
My father had arranged with the authorities, RAF authorities in Singapore, before we left, that they would guarantee our delivery to Britain, notwithstanding the possibility of some disaster en route. So they had undertaken to deliver us back to this country because they had paid for our passage to Singapore in the first place. Part of the contract was that they would take us back to Britain at the end of my father's, had he stayed there full term. We would have come back to Britain with the passage paid for by the Air Ministry. So she didn't have to worry from that standpoint. But it turned into a disadvantage in America, which I'll talk about later. Perth was really like a beehive that's, or an antique perhaps I might say, that's suddenly been turned upside down. And it was not a good place to be at that time. And we didn't have very much to do. It was very, very hot. It was a very small town. There wasn't many places one could go to. we used to go to King's Park and just sit in the park, buy a bag of fruit. They used to have street fruit vendors, barrow boys, on the streets. The fruit in Australia is absolutely wonderful. Peaches, grapes, you name it, bananas, they've got it. And my mother used to say, well, buy a bag of fruit and we'll go and have lunch in the park, because we used to get fed up at the hotel. And we used to do that and have our lunch. She'd buy some bread and butter and cheese and so on. And we'd have a picnic lunch in the park. That was very nice. We did that about three times a week. And I can remember sitting in the park one day. We were having our lunch on the bench, and a group of Australian soldiers were lying on the grass, only about 20 yards from where we were sitting. And down the path came a large contingent of American sailors, and they all had a girl. Each one had a girl on the arm. And the Australian troopers were very, very upset about it, especially when one of the Americans made a dismissive gesture with his hand, you know. And, of course, they had so much more money than anybody. And they were able to attract the girls. And this created a lot of trouble in the streets. And the troopers were, I think, only just about able to accept it, you know.
So how long were you there in Australia before you left for the North England?
We were in Australia. Would have been about 3.5 to 4 months. We were in Perth for about 7 or 8 weeks. But when we'd been in the Shaftesbury Hotel for about a month, 5 weeks, I suppose, a woman turned up one day at the hotel who turned out to be a relative of my mother's on her mother's side back in Plumstead. And she had emigrated with her husband to Western Australia when she was a young woman, immediately after the First World War. And they lived in a desert area north of Perth. And she said that she knew we had been in Singapore, and she'd been to the authorities. She knew our names, of course. And she'd been to the authorities, and she had discovered that we were living in the Shaftesbury Hotel. Well, of course, she knew as well as everybody else that the Shaftesbury Hotel was a brothel. So she came there and said, I live in a small house north of Perth. It was well outside the city. And if you like, you know, you can come and live with me. So at that stage, my mother was all too happy to do this. And especially because only a short time before, my mother had fallen ill. And I think what had happened, she thought that what had happened was that the mosquitoes were awful. And they were even bigger than the ones we were accustomed to in Singapore, and that was bad enough. And they didn't provide any nets, you see. And we used to put the two young children, to bed, in the bed in the evening, and she and I would sit reading. And then just before we went to bed, we'd kill all the mosquitoes that had got into the room. We had to have the window open because of the heat. And I remember my sister Jacqueline, the first sister, she was lying there on the pillow one night, and she'd got six large mosquitoes sitting on her forehead. And I just crushed each one like that. Now, my mother was of the opinion after the war that she had somehow or other been, a mosquito bite had become infected. And it was on her neck. And she became very unwell. And her neck swelled up to about twice its normal size. And she became very, very red. Her skin became very red. And she was in a very bad state. And she said to me, we're not going to tell the hotel, because if I'm taken to hospital, you'll be put in a children's home. So she said, what we're going to do is that we're going to get through this. I'm going to stay in bed and you're going to have to look after the two girls, and you're going to have to take them down to their meals and make sure that everything's okay. Don't go out in the evening when the, you know, the fighting's going on. So. And this is what we did. Now the chambermaids who came to change the linen, of course, realised that this woman was ill in bed. And I'm sure the concierge knew, because she used to ask very pointed questions of me in the morning when we went. I took the two girls down to breakfast, and she'd say, "How's your mother, dear?" And I sensed that there was something behind the questions, and I always say, "She's fine." And then after several days of this, she was getting worse, and she said to me, "I want you to go to the chemist, which is just across the bridge, the one we've already been to, and I want you to get some, I think it was called G's Linctus." She said, "Get me a bottle of that and some cotton wool." So I went to brought it back, and she got me to dab her neck all over with this G's Linctus. And of course it brought up a tremendous flush in the skin. I thought she was dying, as a matter of fact. And I have a feeling that, from what she said after the war, that she thought she was as well. But she didn't say anything to me, of course. And it seemed to work, because about a day and a half later, the swelling suddenly went down. But she was very weak. And I used to take meals up to the... This is why the concierge was asking questions. Because I used to get a meal covered with a cover over it and take it up there, because she... I can never eat more than about a quarter of it. So she wasn't eating properly. And it was roasting hot in the room all the time, virtually. And she was ill. And I was worried. Extremely.
No chance of a doctor? Would there not have been any sort of organisation for refugees
No.
who could have gone to?
No. She didn't want to, because she said to me, "They'll break us up. They will. If a doctor can't..." I said to her, I can remember saying to you, "Let's get a doctor." And she said, "No, we won't go to the doctor, because I'm sure that if I go into hospital, I know that they will put you in. They won't leave you here." So we did that, and eventually she recovered. But she was in a bad state. And she was in a bad state because of anxiety, like, for example, at night, one could hear the noises that all the girls were making in the adjoining rooms, you know. I didn't know what the noises meant, but of course she did, for certain. And she used to plug areas with cotton wool, which, of course, being a boy, and so I, as soon as she turned the light out, I was taking it. And I could hear all these noises, but of course, as I say, I hadn't got the face, so I didn't want to... Why, you know, what was going on at all. That was just one thing. Another thing that was particularly concerning at the time was that my younger sister, who was three, from the day we arrived in Perth, she flatly refused to walk. And my mother and I used to carry her everywhere we went. She had to be carried. And one day, my mother, we were walking along St. George's Terrace, which is one of the main streets in Perth. And my mother said to me, she was carrying Sylvia, and she said to me, "I can't do this anymore." She said, "I'm going to put her down." In those days, St. George's Terrace had a series of park benches along the street. And she said, "I'm going to put her down on this bench, and we're going to walk away." And we did. And we must have gone 300 yards. And she just sat there. And mother said to me, "We can't do this, can't leave her." So we went back, and I picked her up, and I carried her. But between the two of us, we carried her everywhere we went.
Was it to do with the trauma, do you think?
Sure of it, yes. The thing was that in Singapore, she was looked after overwhelmingly. When I say overwhelmingly, I mean out of the 24 hours, about 22 and a half hours, she was looked after by her Chinese aunt. So as a very young child, as a baby, in fact, she would have identified with this Chinese woman.
End of reel 5, Derek.